Hello everyone, it's time for another OneLiner.com podcast. I, as always, am Craig, and with me tonight, Drew.
Greetings.
It will be just the two of us tonight. Scott won't be joining us. Scott unfortunately died. He assured us that he will get better for next podcast, but while he remains dead, it's down to Drew and I to pick up the slack, and what a mighty, mighty amount of slack that is. So without further ado, let's see how we cope, eh? Let's kick off with This Is The End, which is a joint writing and directorial effort from Evan Goldberg and Seth Rogen, in which a party for Hollywood's current stoner in crowd at James Franco's house is interrupted by the biblical apocalypse. If that sounds like a bizarre pitch, you'd be on the money. And this isn't so much high-concept filmmaking as it is the stoned-out-of-one's-mind and off-the-planet variety. Rogen and Franco as themselves are joined by Jonah Hill, Jay Baruchel, Danny McBride and Craig Robinson, all playing themselves, as seemingly the sole Hollywood survivors after the rapture removes a certain percentage of LA's populace and giant fiery chasms opening up in the Earth's crust take care of the rest. What follows is equal parts histrionic survival epic, stoner comedy and redemptive morality tale, which offers gross-out violence, drug-taking and bodily function humour in abundance. I was kind of at a loss, Drew, as to how best to describe This Is The End. It's just a very silly comedy, really, isn't it?
Yeah, the problem with the characters, the actors all playing themselves, people who've been in each other's films, etc., has the potential to be quite astonishingly self-indulgent and very, very inside baseball and very bratty, really.
Yeah.
And it's not, and I can't quite explain why. It's something beyond simply the fact that they relentlessly take the piss out of each other or themselves throughout the whole film. It shouldn't work that, really. It should be insufferable.
Well, yeah, it's asking a lot on faith of the audience. Like, a lot of jokes are made, like, to pick an obvious example, at the start of the film, Michael Cera is there at the party, behaving like a complete douchebag, snorting mountains of coke off every available surface, slapping Rihanna's arse, being a general douchebag, and it's that joke of, hey, oh, we all know. It's funny because we all know Michael Cera's not like that. And, like, with the best will in the world, well, I don't know Michael Cera's not like that.
Yes.
I'll take your word for it that he's a nice guy, but, I've never spent any time cracking with the dude, so.
Yeah, you're basing that on, that's the type of role he plays. He generally, the sort of quite shy, gentlemanly young man, treats people well, and wouldn't it be funny if he's a raging arsehole in real life? And yeah, again, that shouldn't work, but that's actually funny as opposed to being that huge leap of faith.
Yeah. It shouldn't work, and I went in fully expecting it not to work because the whole concept of it is so self-indulgent and theoretically so self-congratulatory that I'm going to go and see this because of some of the people who are in it, and I'm pretty sure it's going to give me a couple of chuckles, but I fully expect to come out asking, well, you know, actually being quite angry about it. And in the end, I don't think I've laughed so hard in a cinema in a long time.
No, good couple of years, I think, since I can remember laughing quite so consistently.
Yeah, the last time I laughed so hard at something like this was probably Pineapple Express or something, which is obviously, you know, from largely the same sort of production group and the same group of actors and whatnot. But there is this air of self-deprecation throughout, which is, the concept is, like, amped to the max, like, to the point where literally, you know, by the end of the film, you've got, like, skyscraper-sized demons, you know, Satan himself is stomping about 200 feet tall, you know, across the Hollywood Hills, wreaking havoc and stuff like this. And the only reason it works so well is because I think the cast have been so invested in spending that amount of effort and indulging that sort of extreme amount of bizarreness and how they approach themselves and how they treat themselves in the film. Everyone seems to have been up for having a laugh, which you would expect of, like, the guys like James Franco and Craig Robinson and Danny McBride.
Yeah. There's an air in there too of that some of it is, some of the things they're saying to each other is actually cutting quite close to the knuckle. Yeah, the feeling that some of that's based on reality, but the very act of making this film has been a catharsis. Yeah. They've got a lot of humour out of it at the same time.
Yeah, and in a sense of the fact that such a mainstream film like this so openly advocates not just the sort of soft topic of cannabis use, but also other hallucinogenic drugs and such like, is also quite startling. But there's no gross out avenue is avoided, and it is by turns inspired and also incredibly puerile. But if you know that going in beforehand, if you're okay with that, I would be very surprised if you laugh more at a film. I went along primarily like Seth Rogen can take him or leave him, but I found him and James Franco to be really a really good comedy pairing in Pineapple Express. I know Seth Rogen is one of these guys who a lot of people either take or leave, and at the very start of the film, a joke is made at his expense about him always playing Seth Rogen.
Yes.
He basically just plays himself in every film. And again, like that's not necessarily much different in this case, but obviously the scenario amps it up a level, and it's like, yeah, this is probably the most sort of extreme stuff that he's done, I should imagine. But Danny McBride, who was in Pineapple Express as well, is someone who, against my best judgment, I've just found it funny in everything that he's done. And everything I've seen him in, he's usually the best thing in everything I've seen him in. From like little bit parts in Tropic Thunder to Eastbound and Down, which has been the funniest programme I've watched in television in years.
The only thing that I've seen him in where I didn't find him funny was something he was not necessarily miscast in, but rather pointlessly cast, and that was as George Clooney's prospective brother-in-law in Up in the Air. But other than that, I think everything I've seen him in, he's been hilarious.
Ah, see, I haven't seen Up in the Air. But the fact that it's that thing of like so many people as well. There are so many cameos, you'll be hard pressed. I mean, the party scene's in the house. Good luck picking everybody out.
Yeah, they've got trouble too with they've basically got far more people than you have useful roles for. Certainly any useful dialogue. So Paul Rudd's in there, who's in Funny People. No, he wasn't Funny People. Sorry, not yet. Yeah, no, Paul Rudd's in there, but he was in there knocked up with Seth Rogen, and he's reduced to running around clutching an enormous bottle of champagne while the earth opens up around him, and that's all they could, whether through time or ability to write more lines, that's all they could do with him.
Yeah. And what's his name, who was behind the Muppet revival recently?
Jason Segel, sorry
Jason, I know he listens to the podcast. Yeah, he's in there for like 10 seconds just hanging about in the background of the party scene, and it's like, alright, okay, cool. Even people who I can't abide, people like Rihanna, she has the grace to turn up and allow herself to be slapped on the arse before punching Michael Cera in the face and then falling down a chasm into a pit of molten lava at the Earth's core. Yes. And it's like, okay, if you're willing to sort of deface your public image that much, although arguably in Riri's case, there's not much of a public image left to deface. But if you're willing to poke that much fun at yourself, it's hard not to offer some amount of goodwill, regardless of how much of a backslapping effort this is.
Yeah.
I actually enjoyed that far, far, far more than I expected to. Am I going to buy it when it comes out on DVD? Am I going to watch it again anytime soon? Probably not, because I don't think it's a joke that'll play twice.
It's not even so much that, though. That's certainly part of it, Craig. The other thing is, it is one of those things that you're really going to get this sort of cascade effect of sitting, watching that with a large audience in a cinema.
Yeah, the shared experience of everyone sitting thinking, my God, a lot of people finding this as awkward as I am. Especially when it was like an older guy sitting like a few seats along from me when we went to see this. And at the most glorious exchange between James Franco and Danny McBride on the subject of how the pages of James Franco's
magazine, yes.
Playboy magazine came to get stuck together in the age of internet porn. I was sitting there finding it quite awkward myself until the guy himself, this guy who I was kind of worried about, oh man, I bet he finds this disgusting, started to laugh probably even more loudly than I was. Yeah. Like, okay.
No, do you know what might help actually with your expectations of this film, whether you enjoy it, is to think you're going to see a different film like I did.
Yes.
Because you said you went in worried about it was going to be very self-indulgent, etc. I went in forgetting that this film existed, I'm absolutely certain we were seeing The World's End because it mixed up the names in my head. And
no.
Hugely puzzled as to why they were putting a trailer for The World's End before the film was about to watch, which was surely The World's End.
At which point did you literally realise that the BBFC title card?
No, I realised that the trailer for The World's End.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, wait, that's this is the end. That's what I'm seeing.
I know what's happened.
Dun, 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 dun. So I totally wasn't prepared in any way for the film, and that possibly helped.
Yeah, fair enough. But yeah, I would recommend checking out, like you say, probably better with an audience.
Yeah, if you can see this either in the cinema just now or, you know, bunch of mates, bunch of beers an evening, it's the more people, the more enjoyment I suspect you'll get out of this. And I can see why people wouldn't like this, the self-indulgent nature we've talked about. But if you're in the right frame of mood and you like anything that basically anybody in it's done, then I think you're going to get a great deal of enjoyment out of it.
Excelente. Right, now you literally have just come out of a screening of World War Z, have you not?
I literally have, with like an hour and a half's travel time in between, where I melted walking home. But
don't suppose you fancy telling us a bit about that?
World War Z. In American, that would be World War Z, which works better because it's meant to be sound like World War III. It's a zombie film, and what do you say about a zombie film? There's some unexplained outbreak, which seems to almost happen everywhere in the world simultaneously. People get bitten, turned into zombies within 12 seconds, and you've basically got an exponential explosion of zombies who are trying to decimate all of the humans. There's a very select handful of people left, and our action focuses on, geez, I can't even remember his bloody name. Don't say Brad Pitt, I know it's Brad Pitt. Jeremy Lin, yes. Our action focuses on...
I was just going to say that.
Our action focuses on Brad Pitt's Jeremy Lin, a former UN special investigator who is brought back in to investigate. Who'd have thunk it? The survivors of the United States and some close by countries are aboard a UN flotilla, which is a flotilla. Yeah, they tend to be.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also irrelevant. So former UN special investigator Jerry is pulled back in to investigate quite where this zombie plague came from. The working hypothesis being that it must be a virus of some kind, because there aren't many of those, so I'm glad they've narrowed it down so well. And he is tasked with going and escorting a doctor, a virologist, to discover the cure. And he gets chased by some zombies. And then he goes to another place and he gets chased by some zombies. And then he flies in a plane and it's full of zombies. And they go to another country where he's chased by some zombies. And then he gets another plane. It's got even more zombies on it. And then it ends. So what I'm saying is, it's largely a film of somebody being chased by some zombies. Which isn't to say it's not entirely without merit. If you disengage your brain, you'd get some small level of enjoyment. I mean, I wasn't entirely bored by it, but from what I understand, and I haven't read it myself, but from what I understand, the book World War Z that this is based on covers the topics of...
Stuff.
Stuff happens and stuff doesn't happen. And then there's the stuff that happens that doesn't happen, it does.
Oh, stuff.
Right, yes. Yeah, so I'll just read this description just to give you an idea. This is what I was trying to say about failing impressively. The book is set 10 years after the zombie war, and passages of it record the war, and they have personal accounts that describe the religious, geopolitical, and environmental changes that result from the war. Which is, as I understand it, is more or less the point of the book. That's how people are affected by this and what changes, and then I suspect there's other things similar to other post-apocalyptic things. World War Z has absolutely none of that in any way whatsoever.
Oh, excellent.
Because I'm not joking, there's a man and he gets chased by some zombies and he gets his family safe and he gets sent off to investigate the zombies who chase him.
He's a man who's not very good at spotting patterns developing.
It's just such a meh film. I know that's not the most eloquent way to describe it, but it's a chase film with the zombies in it. The end is such a anti-climax, which almost feels like it's set up for a sequel until you get sort of a coda describing what happens after the climax, and you're just left feeling, oh, is that it? Which is maybe unfair, given that I'm not sure what you wanted after a film where a man gets chased by some zombies for 2 hours.
Do the zombies finally catch him, grab him on the shoulder and go, you're it, and then run away?
That'd have been a better climax. It'd have been more exciting, certainly. Let's see. There aren't any really positive aspects. There's nothing egregiously bad apart from the CGI zombies don't look fantastic, but there's one or two in particular. One of which looks like it could have come from I Am Legend.
Nice.
Along with the slack-jawed snapping of jaws. And another which looks quite like a ghoul from Fallout 3 or Fallout New Vegas. And about as well rendered. The rest, though, is... If you've seen a zombie film, you know what happens. You know what zombies are like. These are the quick kind. And they chase Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt's personable enough in this as he usually is, but he's largely there to be chased by some zombies. And then... just when you think everything's quiet, zombie chases him, just to, you know, break things up a little.
Just to remind him of why he's there.
Yes, it's... I know I'm struggling to do any justice to any sort of review of this, but it's a man chased by zombies for 2 hours that's not as boring as that would probably normally be. It does have Peter Capaldi in it, who's utterly squandered, so it's got that against it. Everything else is more just... people set up reasons to have him to have somebody to talk to who isn't a zombie in the few moments when he's not being chased by zombies.
I was intrigued by this film when the first trailer started to appear, if for no other reason than this sort of the interesting premise, which I know again is not something that's in the book, but of the sort of the zombie wave, this thing that they make a great deal of in the trailers, of sort of like these rapidly moving, these sort of they're like your 28 Days Later sort of scary fast zombies, aren't they?
Yeah.
Of them moving en masse in crowds that behave like waves, like spilling over.
Yeah. See, even that, though,
obstacles
that's,
and things.
That sort of bothered me as much as it just, I know the idea is that the humans, when they're bitten, become zombies almost immediately. It's 12 seconds. By the time the film gets going, there's some reference to it taking a bit longer earlier on. But the virus has evolved, the zombies turn almost immediately.
but for the purposes of narrative later in the film, we'll require it to happen quicker than that.
Yes. No, from the beginning, it's 12 seconds. So the idea would be that basically, you know, it's an exponential growth. You've got, you know, a million humans, two zombies, but within a few minutes, that's turned around. Mm. But even then, you've seen these huge overhead shots of, like, as you're doing the trailer of the zombies piling up the wall. And there are other, like, wide shots and aerial shots of huge swarms of zombies. And that was actually taking me out of it, because I was just thinking, is that not too many? Where are all of these people in this small city for? Why are they all here? And that is the least of its problems. It took me out of it. But you mentioned the trailer, something kind of odd. It's irrelevant, I guess, because it doesn't actually go anywhere in the film. But in the trailer, they mentioned that Brad Pitt goes, how did I get into Russia? And the guy says to him, Russia's a black hole. In the film, it's changed to India. And there doesn't appear to be any reason, because he doesn't go to either of them.
Really? Yeah.
Which puzzled me. It seems a very odd change.
I'd have that trailer up under the Trade Descriptions Act. I wanted to see the black hole of Russia.
I couldn't recommend seeing it. It's not great. I mean, if you want to see a man chased by zombies, this is your film. Because, in case you haven't picked this up, Brad Pitt gets chased by zombies a lot.
And he is a man.
There's almost no tension in it either, because you're waiting 3 minutes because you just know there will be some zombies along soon. Mm. The only time they manage to build any tension is when they go to Wales.
There's a counterintuitive avenue for the narrative to go around.
They go to Wales for a reason, largely because they were chased by zombies somewhere else, and they haven't been chased by zombies in Wales yet.
Were they chased by zombies in England and then they had to run across the border into Wales to be chased somewhere different?
I'll leave that as a surprise for you.
All right, okay.
Yeah, I said they managed the tension once, and there's just a wee bit of tension, and they say, Nah, nah, just back to being chased by zombies then.
Well, at least you know what you're getting.
Their status, I suppose.
So World War Z, don't bother.
Nah.
Hummingbird, or Redemption, as it will be slightly more directly known in the overseas market, stars Jason Statham as a homeless ex-military man, Joey.
Well, why Hummingbird then?
Oh, because there's hummingbirds in it.
Oh, that's a good reason. They might just call it lampposts. I bet there are lampposts in it.
Imaginary ones, but hummingbirds nonetheless. Yeah, right. You could probably equally call it lampposts, because a lot of it takes place outdoors. But Jason Statham is homeless ex-military man Joey, living a rough life on the streets of London in order to avoid being court-martialed for desertion. After a particularly nasty mugging by an organised criminal gang, Joey's street friend Isabel becomes sidelined into prostitution, and as he seeks to reunite with her, Joey forges a friendship with kind-hearted nun Christina, played by Agata Buzek. I'm doing her name justice there. Agata, I know she listens to the podcast. Without giving too much away, things soon take a turn for the worse, and Joey finds himself playing Avenging Angel, working his way through the ranks of trust of a Chinese gang in order to facilitate his mission of redemption. There's a lot going on in Hummingbird, and not all of it makes sense all of the time. But I am damned, Drew, I am damned if at some point Jason Statham is not going to be given a good role in a great film, and we will all come to appreciate his skill and mastery of the acting profession. I'm saying that only half jokingly because Jason Statham is a massively likable presence
Jason
in almost
Statham.
Everything I've seen him in. Yeah,
just, I don't know whether it's him, casting directors, or his agent, but I was liking to see him once being something different.
This is the problem, is that you can tell that he's keen to stretch himself, and this is probably, without pouring through his back catalogue, I'm sure there might be one or two other little oddments, but this is the closest I've seen him come to doing something along the lines of a straight-laced drama, which, unfortunately, apparently is some sort of concession to this typecasting which you mention. It is necessary at a couple of points in the film for him to kick a couple of guys' heads in. But he's doing it in a much more matter-of-fact way than the sort of acrobatic silliness of stuff like the Transporter series and things like that. But it's a very, very strange atmosphere this film has. It's set in Soho in London, and it avoids the tropes therein where we've seen a lot of films like that where focuses on the neon glow on the pavement and that sort of really dark and seedy underbelly. There's not so much of that here, although it's obviously set amongst the human detritus of a particular section of society. For the most part, it avoids that, and it has a distinct style of its own, but perhaps only because it's strangely disjointed. I thought it's quite a scattershot style. I couldn't tell you who the cinematographer was, but I wasn't blown away by it. It was kind of humdrum, but in a way that suits the atmosphere of the film. It's this really strange vibe, which I was thinking about this earlier, and I thought if I had to sum it up, I would say it's as though someone has sat down and they've decided to cross-pollinate an episode of the A-Team with an episode of The Littlest Hobo. And
so they go into a shed full of some straw, some oxyacetylene torches and some scrap metal, and they create a dog tank.
Yes, they come out with a giant shaggy dog that fires watermelons. which is of course exactly the plot of that well-known Littlest Hobo A-Team crossover episode. It's difficult to find something to say. Like, Statham always seems on the cusp of doing something better, and the areas in which the film succeeds are all related to his performance and his investment. I really can't. There's so much going on. Scott and I spoke about this after we'd been to see it together, and I think it's safe to say he probably took more away from it than I did. He enjoyed it a little bit more. I found it quite disjointed and quite difficult to invest myself in, apart from the sort of the sympathetic nature of Statham's character. But I feel like I want to say that it's less than the sum of its parts. There's stuff to be enjoyed, but it just didn't quite gel for me. It felt a little bit more suited to felt more like a Saturday night special. It should have been something which was on television rather than in cinemas or something like that. Mm-hmm. It probably would have worked better as like a two-part, like a two-hour TV drama or something like this. But yeah, there's all sorts of curious stuff going on in here. And like, everyone in the cast acquits themselves well enough. Statham gets some cracking lines, which I think I've told you about already, but I've decided my favourite is most definitely... I brought you here because I thought you'd like the photographs. I didn't know they were going to be of men's penises. That's up there with my favourite bits of dialogue of the year so far.
Although, I think may have said this to you when we were talking about when you were telling me about it last week, but it's no the energy divides amongst its survivors, though.
No, of course, nothing ever will be. The energy divides among the survivors.
I don't think you've got quite enough different accents in there.
I'll need to work on it a bit. But yeah, this I hadn't seen this Agata Buzek lady before who plays the nun Christina, and she brings quite a lot of heart to the film for her part. She's a very sympathetic character and portrayed in a very naturalistic, believable way. Mm-hmm. And as Joey's relationship turns from one of friendship to being something more than that with this this well-meaning character. There's that. I found that to be a more interesting bit of narrative than I did much of the rest of the film, to be honest. Mm-hmm. It's in any one of those elements, this whole notion of him having a relationship with a nun or the girl being taken from the street and sidelined into prostitution or even Joey's estranged relationship with his ex-wife and his daughter, who I wish I could remember the name of the actress. She was in This Is England. She appears as Statham's estranged wife, and again, there's like all sorts of hints of interesting things that could happen there, and nothing much comes of any of it apart from this relationship with the nun, which Vicky McClure, that's the one. So yeah, it felt like a lot of missed opportunities, and it felt like it sort of meandered quite a bit, and it didn't ever really know what it wanted to be. But it is, I do think it is going to be, I would like to hope that it's going to be notable for the reason of marking a change in direction in the kinds of roles that Statham is going to get offered, because I want to see him doing as much fun as those films have been. He's quite capable of doing that sort of thing in his sleep.
Yeah, well,
the whole action guy stuff. I want to see him do more of. I want to see him being offered more roles that stretch him, because I think he's a remarkably likable screen presence, yeah, and I think he's been paid short thrift
or shrift even.
Shrift, yes.
Yeah, I like Jason Statham a lot, and much as I love things like the Crank films in particular, it's certainly my favourite Jason Statham roles. Mm. I don't want to see him being a hard man in his 60s like Arnie or Sylvester Stallone, much as I enjoyed the more recent Rocky Balboa and Rambo films. I don't want to see a 60-year-old Statham tottering around pretending he can beat people up.
Mm.
I would like to just see him, you know, do some acting, like get his teeth into a role, because at the very least I'd like to see him try it, so we yeah. all know just what he's capable of.
I'd like to see someone put him in one of these modern Shakespeare adaptations.
Oh, look, if Keanu Reeves can get cast in Shakespeare, Jason Statham can.
Exactly. Someone give this man the right role and let him do us proud. It's like waiting on Andy Murray to win Wimbledon. Sorry, spoiler alert.
there's something you haven't covered. It seems an important point to me, Craig, about having heard just for my own edification. How many people, or how many times do people get chased by zombies?
Let me think. None.
0 stars.
Oh, there you go. I was going to say 3. I was going to say a solid 3, but lack of zombie chasing. No stars. Now, Man of Steel, one of this summer's largest tentpole productions, is the Chris Nolan-produced, Zack Snyder-directed reboot of DC Comics' Superman franchise, which severs all ties with previous installments and goes for the origin story angle once again. Relative unknown English actor Henry Cavill fills Supes' boots this time around, and gone is the cartoonish overtone of both the original series of films and Bryan Singer's 2006 attempt in favour of something a little darker and more menacing. Man of Steel pits Superman against arch-enemy General Zod, a role originally filled by Terrence Stamp and here by the very much ascendant Michael Shannon. Amy Adams reports for duty as Lois Lane, and the rest of the cast is rounded out by Kevin Costner, Lawrence Fishburne, Diane Lane and Russell Crowe. Right, you and I managed to catch up with Man of Steel finally last week, Drew, and I get the sense that I think our opinions probably converge slightly towards the end, but I think we've gotten there by different paths. I think we probably, I feel like I want to say we had different experiences with the film.
That would be my impression, yes.
Let me start by saying I don't, overall, I found it to be wanting. I find it difficult because I find myself judging it against that 2006 attempted reboot that Bryan Singer pulled out the bag, and both have their pros and cons, and I don't really feel it's fair to judge them both against each other. I think overall I was slightly disappointed by the film because of the final couple of acts.
My immediate reaction was to say I was bored by it, but if I think about it now, I wasn't, because it's 146 minutes, and that didn't really feel like that. So that was
suggesting
that I wasn't actually bored, but I certainly wasn't enormously enthused. Although, why though?
This is the way I feel about it. The first hour, hour and a half of this film contains moments which, when they're good, I think are the best a Superman film has been done. I can't necessarily put my finger on all of them, but there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot more action here we see in terms of what happened on... What happens on Krypton in order that Superman be sent to Earth by his father, Russell Crowe, which we haven't seen before in the films, and gives some interest and insight into his parents, and also the sort of rebellion which was happening, eco-apocalypse-led rebellion which was happening on Krypton at the time of his dispatch.
Yeah, certainly, what it does quite successfully is makes the villain A, more interesting, and B, much more sympathetic.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, and what I was actually disappointed with the performance, I really like Michael Shannon. I think he's particularly good in Boardwalk Empire, The Missing Person, which Scott and I saw at the Edinburgh International Film Festival a few years ago. I just think he was miscast in this.
I've like you say, the Zod is fleshed out much more than in the Terrence Stamp iteration, and his motivations are understandable.
Yeah, that's
you can see how a character like that would go down that path.
Terrence Stamp's really quite iconic in the role, and it's a better performance. It's a performance that seems to fit it better. There's a cold menace about Terrence Stamp, whereas for Michael Shannon's role, it's basically based on anger, which I don't think works as well. But in the original Superman films, Richard Donner one, Zod seems to be a bit annoyed somebody trapped him in a sheet of perspex for a few years, seems to be his main motivation, whereas in Man of Steel he's part of a warrior caste, he's bred to protect Krypton, and that's what he believes he's doing. And while there's some hint of a revenge element against Jor-El's son, largely he's going there because he wants to retrieve something that will help him to recreate Krypton on a new planet. And that makes him both much more interesting. His motivations are much more compelling and understandable. And because he's been bred for this role, effectively, I mean, it's genetic engineering, really, then you can't absolutely say he's an evil person because he's doing what he's meant to do, what he's programmed for.
It
makes it a very interesting character. I just don't think, unfortunately, in this case, Michael Shannon was the person to do it, although
It could have been written better, but at the same time, I feel like Michael Shannon dropped the ball. I feel like watching this film, that the whole time I was watching him, he was just kind of bored. He wasn't investing as much in the role as I hoped someone like he would.
The problem is, I think the whole film suffers, and most notably him and Henry Cavill, though, from there not being enough dialogue.
There's
far too much action, particularly in the last third, and there's not enough talking. And it's
bizarrely, a lot
really
of the character building stuff on Superman's part is done in flashbacks by his. A lot of the talking is done by his father, played by Kevin Costner, in flashbacks to his childhood on Earth.
Yeah.
When he was growing up, Superman himself doesn't actually. Henry Cavill himself, like you said, doesn't have as much dialogue as you would expect. We rely on this narrative technique of every time sort of adult Superman finds himself facing some sort of difficulty or problem, we flash back to a similar instance in his formative years and how his father, how his Earth father influenced him. And there's not that much sort of tactile character feedback from Superman himself as there is sort of just other people telling him, well, this is what you must do to become a man.
I know, but then
this is why we have to protect you and we can't tell people who you are. And
there are hints of it too, of that you see that's gone to him, that he knows he's powerful and for various reasons, like for instance he could hurt other people, that he's got to restrain himself, and there's some just small but incredibly effective scenes to that end. There's a scene where somebody attacks him in a bar.
Yeah.
And Superman could blink and kill this guy.
He makes a complete ass out of him in a bar and he just has to walk away.
And he
away.
Just bites his lip, walks away. And there's a nice bit of humour there as to how he gets some sort of not revenge, but has some sort of effect on this guy without hurting him.
Yeah.
And so there's bits like that we see that the teachings and stuff have gone through. But one of the things that particularly bothered me about this film is that he won't hurt this one guy in a bar, but that's entirely undermined by the entire third act of the film, where everybody's dying and he doesn't appear to care.
Yeah. let's talk about that third act, because to me, first of all, like the first couple of acts of that movie, I was kind of enjoying as much because I was surprised at the restraint that Zack Snyder was showing. Like, I'm no fan of Zack Snyder, even I know you and Scott really enjoyed Watchmen,
yes.
But I still have to give it a second watch. I wasn't sold on it. But here, I felt like, wow, they've actually given him something. They've given him some material here and almost dared him to show some sort of restraint.
Yeah, well,
and
there are...
I think for a Zack Snyder film, there was probably more dialogue than we'd be used to, more meaningful dialogue than we'd be used to.
There's some really nice low key moments. Even though in this towards the start, Superman's basically Wolverine. He's this loner wandering around, but you see him. He's on a fishing vessel. He's basically just taking hard jobs, but jobs where he can be anonymous. He's on a crab boat, and there's an oil rig fire. He goes and helps him, but because he realizes people have seen him. He sort of just drifts off, finds a job somewhere else, tries to blend in. He's trying not to stand out. He's trying to stop anybody following him. As I said, he's basically been Wolverine. But that's sort of really low-key stuff. It's simple action, and it's not a lot of dialogue, but that works there. You get a real idea of the character here and what he's trying to do and why.
Yeah.
And that's really actually restraining. It's the most effective stuff in the film, I feel.
Yeah, and I think it's some of the most effective snuff. It's no doubt some of the most effective snuff Zack Snyder has done, but also the most effective stuff he has done. Some of the most effective stuff he's done, and I found myself thinking, oh, this is a Zack Snyder film I might actually enjoy. There is actually some semblance of talent to this guy, but it becomes immediately obvious the point at which the script sat in front of Zack Snyder. The dialogue finishes, and then there's just a bit in the centre of one page that says Superman and Zod fight for an hour.
Yes.
And at that point, you can...
It's hugely
at that
top,
point in the film,
it?
Yeah, you can just... You can feel him just going, woohoo, this is the bit where I wrangled with him in the contract that it wouldn't all be talky stuff, and I would get to fuck everything up. And everything gets blown up, everything gets torn apart, the collateral damage...
It's astonishing.
To the entire planet, yeah. And the third act of this film is unbelievable.
Yeah, but that's the thing, and I've heard other people talk about this too, but it certainly was bothering me at the time, and it's continued to bother me since.
Yeah.
There are all these fights, and let's disregard the fact that quite how foolish the very end of the fight is and why it happens, because, you know, just could you not just, like, jump over that thing there? People in danger. I don't think that's giving anything away.
No.
Let's disregard that, in fact, it goes on for far too long. They more or less get nuke each other, and nothing happens. The problem is that, yeah, there's all this collateral damage, and Superman's spent the first half of the film, he won't even punch a guy in a bar who was being unpleasant to a woman.
Yeah.
But people are dying left, right, and centre. The number of people in the buildings in Metropolis alone that must have died, and Superman doesn't care. He doesn't make one attempt. You never see him make one attempt to save anybody, you know, which is...
Yeah, time out from giving Zod a duffin to go and actually save someone.
I mean,
yeah.
I always found Superman quite a dull character. I mean, because he's got no weaknesses. He's a god. And it's not the most interesting thing. But when you can have something interesting with Superman, it's the fact that he knows how powerful he is and how many people could be inadvertently hurt. And he's always trying to help people instead. Whereas he's just flinging Zod through a building. And of course, all the people in that building will be fine when Zod lands in it, right?
When it falls over.
Yes.
As an alarming number of them do.
There's no hint anywhere in that film of him going, oh, Jesus, what have I done? Which is a huge failing.
It's startling. The other problem we have now in setting up, I mean, it so obviously sets itself up as the start of a franchise, and that having him tackle Zod in the first film and the sort of the apocalyptic scenarios that he is put through and survives in his way to, again, it's no spoiler to say, okay, he defeats Zod, is what exactly is the threat going to be in
Craig,
the next film that he can't handle by
I think you've spoiled it entirely there, and we'll have to edit that out, because you're letting people know that Superman won. Come on now.
I know.
Bit of consideration, please.
Can you imagine if Zod had won? What's the scenario going to be in the next film that he can't handle by farting in its general direction?
That's exactly what Scott said as well when he was talking. I haven't seen this. You saw it a few weeks before we did.
Yeah.
And he was saying, yeah, it was Zod's the only person who can go toe-to-toe with Superman, and they've shot their bolt in the first film. So what you're left with is basically, ooh, magic crystals.
Yeah. Indeedly doodly. It'll be interesting to see. I noticed that little bits and bobs in there. There was some stuff, hints at the Luther brand throughout the film, in little background shots and stuff. I'd be interested to see if the next film's going to conjure up that. Although I kind of hope it doesn't, because Lex Luthor...
He's been done to death, hasn't it?
He's been done to death, but...
is he not fighting... I've never seen it, but is he not fighting Lex Luthor Jr., Lex Luthor, the young person, every single week in Smallville for about 10 seasons?
Probably. I just find the Lex Luthor character a bit too comical to fit in with the tone of this, so
it doesn't fit the sort of more Christopher Nolan-ish feel to it.
So I'll be interested to see, but yeah, it's almost, I want to say it's like one half of a, it's definitely one half of a good film, and I have somewhat had some faith restored in Zack Snyder, but I just feel like that last act proves that he's sort of incapable of keeping stuff on a tight rein when he's given enough of a budget and enough space to, act like a child.
There are interesting bits in the beginning. I feel the flashback thing may be slightly overused, but rather than... I mean, much as I like the original Superman the movie, it is like an hour of backstory till the film actually starts.
Yeah.
And so they get around that. Some other car. To get around that, and there were some. It's the low key moments are the far more interesting ones. And then the best. I think I did mention this. I was a little bit worried about Man of Steel when we discussed The Cold Light of Day last year, possibly the year before. It's the only time I'd ever seen Henry Cavill at that point.
Yeah.
And I'm relieved to see that it was just everybody having an off day in that film, and it wasn't just him being terrible.
Yeah,
because he's quite likable in this, and there's. I wish he had more dialogue. I wish Michael Shannon had more, or possibly wasn't in the film. Somebody else was, but still with more dialogue. So there were good points, and Kevin Costner's the real top performance as far as I'm concerned. There's a slight problem with it. A lot of his best lines are in the trailer. That's a mark in the department for you again.
Yeah,
but. Just some of the points of that bit in the trailer where his voice cracks just when he says, "You are my son."
Can I say as well what a pleasure it was to have Russell Crowe indulging in some acting again after after I found myself fighting his corner over Les Miserables in which a lot of people were accused him of just phoning in his performance almost. He does notably make more of an effort here to act. And yes, well done, Russell Crowe.
Yeah, both the fathers are among the better and more interesting performances in this. The Lois Lane character...
Amy Adams, she's dealt a bit of a bad hand, really, isn't she?
Yeah, but I sort of let that one slide because you know that's going to be a continuing character going on. It's not so bad. But Lawrence Fishburne as Perry White may as well not be there. I don't understand why he was.
It must have just been a nice paycheck for him.
Yeah.
Keep his profile up.
But yeah, Diane Lane's... She's okay. She's not given a huge lot of really interesting stuff to do.
No, considering the length of the film, suspiciously little, eh?
Yeah, but... Kevin Costner's definitely the most enjoyable performance there. I wish he'd had more, actually. Rather than just seeing him in a few flashbacks, they'd been much more satisfying if he'd had some more lines, but he's come out with the best credit. There were some good things in there. It's not all bad by any means, and as I said, thinking about it since, I can't have been bored, or at least to begin with, because the time seemed to fly by, but just the end, it's like, oh, look, there's some CGI buildings getting falling over. And they smack the CGI man to the CGI man, and then, oh, look, it's an hour of people smacking each other in the mouth and nobody's getting hurt.
Yeah.
Because there's absolutely no effect. And after 10 minutes of people getting constantly punched by each other, by Kryptonians, and not one thing of consequence seems to happen to them. It's just so bored. And then there's the whole thing of Superman not caring about the consequences of his actions, too. So I was very disappointed with the final third.
Kind of lets it down a bit, especially when so much was obviously invested in making an effort in the first hour or so. It feels like just this huge concession to the fact that, well, this is a summer movie, stuff better blow up at some point or audiences will be disappointed. A little bit a wasted opportunity, but at the same time, I'm interested to see where they'll go with the second one now.
It's something I meant to mention and I forgot now. Superman discovers a former Kryptonian scout ship at some point. It sort of becomes like the Fortress of Solitude thing. I don't think it's a spoiler to mention this. But for some reason, this ship from 10,000 years ago comes equipped with his Superman outfit. They send their scout ships out equipped with silly clothing.
Yeah.
That's never adequately explained.
And not only that, but the robot sentinels act a bit dickish and he has to destroy them.
Yes.
Bizarre. Oh, that was the other thing as well. I think you and I discussed it. I said after we came out as well that there is a bit the whole of this film could have been negated actually just by Jor-El keeping his mouth shut.
Yes,
at the start.
Exactly.
It's a bit bizarre that at the start of the film he basically tells Zod his entire plan.
I'm sending the thing you desire greatly away. You didn't know I even had it, and this is where I put it. I'm sending it here, and my son's in it too.
Dull. Yeah, that was a bit odd, but other than that. So, yeah, Man of Steel, interesting. Thank you for putting up with the pair of us lumbering along through such poorly prepared material. Scott promises to be back for the next podcast, and you can look forward to a much deeper level of insight on that part, because generally he's the only one who makes any effort. Drew and I are here to bookend the frequencies of his voice with some input, basically to flesh out the sound a little bit. We'll be discussing things such as A Field in England and what else? Pacific Rim, hopefully, next time we speak to you.
Yeah, and we'll also be talking about Jack Reacher, which we missed in the cinema last year but we caught up with recently.
Yes, we'll be talking about that as well, but for the meantime, fare thee well. I was Craig and Drew was Drew.
Goodbye.
And Scott was dead. Thanks, guys. Take care. We'll speak to you soon. Bye.